Francisco call. Do I look like one? I turn my chair so I can look in the mirror. I don't see the face of a librarian. There is no smooth, high, white forehead. I do not see the calm, placid, composed countenance of the student. The forehead I see is high enough, but it is lined with furrows that look like knife scars. There are two vertical furrows between my eyes that make me appear to be wearing a continual scowl. My eyes are wide enough apart and not small, but they are hard, cold, calculating. They are blue, but of that shade of blue farthest removed from the violet. My nose is not long, not sharp. Nevertheless, it is an inquisitive nose. My mouth is large. One corner of it is higher than the other, and I appear to be continually sneering. I do not scowl. I do not sneer. Yet there is something in my face that causes a man or woman to hesitate before asking to be directed to Dr. Gordon's church. I can't remember a time that any woman, young or old, ever stopped me on the street and asked to be directed. Once in a great while, a drunk will roll over to where I am standing and ask how he can get to 9th and Mission. If I gaze into the mirror long enough and think hard enough, I can conjure up another face. The old one seems to dissolve, and in its place I see the face of a schoolboy. A bright, shining, innocent face. I see a mop of white hair, a pair of blue eyes, and an inquisitive nose. I see myself standing on the broad steps of the Sisters Convent School. At the age of 14, after 3 years board and tuition, I am leaving to go home to my father, and then to another school for big boys. My teacher, a sweet, gentle sister, a Madonna, is holding my hand. She is crying. I must hurry away or I will be crying too. The Mother Superior says goodbye. Her thin lips are pressed so tightly together that I can barely see the line where they meet. She is looking into my eyes intently, and I am wondering what she is going to say to me when the crunching of gravel warns us that the old coach is ready and I must be off. The mother takes my teacher gently by the hand. I see them go through the wide door and disappear silently down the long dark hall. All the boys in the school, and there were 50 of them, lined up and gave me a noisy send-off. The old coachman clucked to his horses, and I was off for the train and the world. Any reader with a spoonful of imagination can picture me going home, then to other schools in turn, then to some sort of an office job, advancement here and there, always leading a well-ordered, quiet, studious life, until he finally places me in the respectable and responsible position of librarian of a metropolitan newspaper. That's the way it should have been, but wasn't. The course I followed from that convent school to this library desk, if charted on a piece of paper, would look like the zigzag line that statisticians use to denote the rise and fall of temperature, or rainfall, or fluctuations of business. Every turn I made was a sharp one, a sudden one. In years I cannot remember making one easy, graceful, rounded turn. It has often been a question with me just how much the best of it a boy has. Who has his mother with him until his feet are well planted under him? Who has a home and its influences until he gathers some kind of a working philosophy that helps him face the world? There is no substitute for the home and the mother. It may not mean much to the average chap to have a friend say, "John, I want you to meet my mother." To me, it means more than I can put on paper. It seems to explain to me why the man who so proudly says, "This is my mother," is so many things that I am not and never can be. The insurance people have not yet got to the stage of insuring a man against a lifetime of failure. But if they ever do, I imagine the chap who can guarantee them that he will keep his mother with him until he is 20 will have a shade the best of it when he pays his premium. I am not lugging in the fact that I was left motherless at the age of 10 to alibi myself away from anything. Nevertheless, I think a fellow has the right to ask himself if things might not have been different. My mother died before I got very well acquainted with her. I doubt if any child gives its parents much thought before the age of 12 or 13. I probably thought that my mother was a person put into the world to scrub my face and neck, and to be screamed and kicked at, to put scratchy flannel rags around my neck with smelly grease on them when I had the croup, and to stand by the bed and keep me in it when I had the measles. I can remember distinctly how angry I became when she brought me a nice new toothbrush and showed me what to do with it. This was the greatest indignity of all. A last straw. I threw the thing away and refused to use it. Told her up and down that I was no girl and wouldn't have any girl things. She did not get angry and scold. She just went on with her work, smiling. She may have been pleased with my manly outburst. I don't know. I don't remember that I was shocked or pained when she was buried. I cried because it was expected of me. Mother's relatives, a couple of sisters whom I never saw before or since, were crying. I saw tears in my father's eyes. So I tried to cry, and did. I know my father realized what we had lost, and his grief was genuine, but I could not feel it then. A few days later, Father sold our little cottage home and furnishings, and we moved into the only hotel in the little town. Schools were few and far between for poor children then. I played around the hotel all day, running wild, till Father came home from work. He would have his dinner, read a paper, and then put me to bed. After that, he would read a book for an hour and go to bed himself. We lived this way for almost a year. Some nights he would put down his book and look at me strangely for minutes at a time. I was a problem, undoubtedly, and he was trying to decide what to do with me. A 10-year-old boy without a mother is a fit problem for any father's mind, and my father was a thoughtful man. Looking back at it, it seems to me that I was blown here and there like a dead leaf, whipped about by the autumn winds till at last it finds lodgment in some cozy fence corner. When I left school at 14, I was as unsophisticated as a boy could be. I knew no more of the world and its strange way than the gentle, saintly woman who taught me my prayers in the convent. Before my 20th birthday, I was in the dock of a criminal court, on trial for burglary. I was acquitted, but that is another story. In 6 years, I had deserted my father and home, gone on the road. I had become a snapper-up of small things, a tapper of tills, a street-door sneak thief, prowler of cheap lodging houses, and at last, a promising burglar in a small way. At 25, I was an expert house burglar, a nighttime prowler, carefully choosing only the best homes, homes of the wealthy, careless, insured people. I made them in the small hours of the night, always under arms. At 30, I was a respected member of the Yegg Brotherhood, a thief of which little is known. He is silent, secretive, wary, forever traveling, always a night worker. He shuns the bright lights, seldom straying far from his kind, never coming to the surface. Circulating through space with his always ready automatic, the Yegg rules the underworld of criminals. At 40, I found myself a solitary, capable journeyman highwayman, an escaped convict, a fugitive, with a background of 25 years in the underworld. A bleak background, crowded with robberies, burglaries, and thefts too numerous to recall, all manner of crimes against property, arrests, trials, acquittals, convictions, escapes, penitentiaries. I see in the background 4 of them. County jails, workhouses, city prisons, mounted police barracks, dungeons, solitary confinement, bread and water hanging up, brutal floggings, and the murderous straitjacket. I see hop joints, wine dumps, thieves' resorts, and beggars' hangouts. Crime followed by swift retribution in one form or another. I had very few glasses of wine as I traveled this route. I rarely saw a woman smile, and seldom heard a song. In those 25 years, I took all these things, and I am going to write about them. And I am going to write about them as I took them, with a smile. Chapter 2. I was a problem to my father, running loose about the hotel while he was at work, and finally he took me to a Catholic school 100 miles away. On that short trip, my father and I got to be good friends, and I think I was closer to him that day than on any other of our lives. Father left that evening and told me to be good, mind the sisters, and study hard. I fell into my groove in the school with other boys of my age. Our days were passed pleasantly with our small studies, many prayers, and daily attendance at Mass. The food was coarse but wholesome. I never went home at vacation time. I spent those days in exploring nearby orchards, gardens, and fields, picking up fruit, vegetables, and berries, and other things that helped take the edge off a small boy's appetite. I spent much time about the barns and stables with Thomas, the coachman. I was an expert listener, a rare talent, inherited from my father, no doubt. Thomas was a ready talker. This is a combination that never fails to make firm and lasting friendships, and we became friends. He was a veteran of our Civil War, and been on the losing side and came out of it full of hatred, lead, and rheumatism. His heroes were not Lee or Stonewall Jackson, but Quantrell, the Gorilla, Jesse and Frank James, Cole and Bob Younger. I never tired of listening to his war stories, and often found myself piecing them together in the schoolroom when I should have been active with my studies. I believe I was the only boy at the school who never went away on holidays and vacations to visit parents or relatives. The Sister Superior, probably realizing that my life was a bit too drab, often gave me the privilege of going to the village for mail and papers. This was a rare treat, and much sought by all the boys. It meant a long walk, a stroll down the village street, a chance to see people, maybe to buy a fat sandwich, a bag of peanuts, or a bottle of pop. No small things in a boy's life. It also meant authority and responsibility. Good things for a boy. I looked forward to these journeys. I always had a little small silver for spending from my father. The time passed quickly and pleasantly enough. I learned many prayers, practiced for singing in the church choir, and became an altar boy, serving the priest at Mass. I liked learning the prayers and the Latin responses to the priest, but did not make much headway with my other studies. I liked the dear, simple old priest to whom I made my first confession, and at times thought I would like someday to be a priest myself. Between my admiration for old Thomas, the coachman, the stormy stories of the war, and my love for the quiet old priest, my mind was always pulling me this way and that. Whether I should become a priest, or a soldier like Tommy, limping around with his short leg and his rheumatism. One day, when I was waiting for the mail, I heard a nice old lady ask the postmaster whose boy I was. He said, "That's one of the boys from the convent. You can tell them a block away. They are all perfect little gentlemen. They say please and thank you. I do not know how the sisters do it, but they can surely bring boys up. I wish I could do it with mine." When I returned with the mail, I told the superior what I heard the postmaster say about her and her boys. She seemed very much pleased, smiled, and said, "Boys are good when they are taught to say their prayers and to fear God." Shortly after, I was appointed mailman. I went to the village every day after school. When the weather was fine, I walked. If it was bad, I rode in or on the coach with Tommy. This was the first and only appointment of my life. I did not think it over then, but I know now I was not given it because I said please or my prayers. I got it because I had told the superior the nice things the postmaster said. Please is a good word in its place, but it does not get one appointed to anything. It has a proper place in a small boy's vocabulary, and it is also much used by a certain class of prisoners and supplicants who are always pleasing somebody and are never pleasant to anybody. Your capable beggar on the street does not say please. He rips off his spiel in such exact and precise language that he gets your dime without it. You so admire his art that you do not miss the please. His is an art. He omits the please because he knows you do not use it except when you want the mustard. Looking back, it seemed to me that our life in the convent was not properly balanced. We had none of the rough, boisterous times so dear to the small boy. No swimming, baseball, football. We were a little too cloistered, too quiet, too subdued. There was no wrestling, no boxing, no running and jumping and squabbling and shuffling and shouldering about. Of course, I learned all those later. But I learned them quickly, too quickly, all in a bunch. That put me out of balance again. Those exercises should have been mixed in with my studies and prayers. One stormy day I came out of the post office and, as usual, handed up the paper to Tommy, whose habit it was to glance at the headlines and return it to me. This day, however, he found something that interested him. He put the horse's lines between his legs and crossed his knees on them. I sat beside him on the box and shivered in the wind. He read on and on, column after column, then turned to an inner page, fighting the paper in the wind. At last, and it seemed an hour, he folded it up carefully and returned it to me.
Good news today, Tommy?
No, boy. No good news. Bad news. Awful news. Terrible news. He spoke in an awed voice, a voice that carried reverence. Terrible news. Jesse James has been murdered. Murdered in cold blood and by a traitor. He fell silent and spoke to me no more that day. Later, he told me many things about Jesse James. He worshipped him, and like many other good people of Missouri, firmly believed that neither of the James boys ever fired a shot except in defense of their rights. I delivered the mail and hastened to tell the other boys that Jesse James was dead, murdered. Many of the older boys knew all about him. He was their hero, too, and the things they told me made me decide to get the paper and read his story myself. The next day, strangely enough, I passed the superior's office when she was out to lunch. The paper was folded neatly, lying on some older papers on the corner of her neat desk. I walked in and took it. I put it away carefully, but many days passed before I got to the reading of it. I was so occupied with my duties as altar boy and so busy with preparing for my first communion and learning new prayers that the James boys and all the other worldly things had no place in my mind. Those were intense days. I lived in another world. At last, I found time to read my paper. On my way for the mail, I slowly dug out the story of Jesse James's life and death, word by word. How I studied the picture of this bearded and papistal hero, and the sketches of his shooting in the house in which it was done. Then came the story of his bereaved mother. How my boyish sympathy went out to her, as she wept for her loss, and told the story of the lifelong persecution of her boys, Jesse and Frank, and how she feared that the hunted fugitive, Frank James, would also be dealt with in the same traitorous fashion. How I loathed the traitor, Bob Ford, one of the James boys' gang, who shot Jesse when his back was turned, for a reward. How I rejoiced to read that Ford was almost lynched by friends and admirers of Jesse, and had to be locked in the strongest jail in the state to protect him from a mobbing. I finished the story entirely and wholly in sympathy with the James boys and all other hunted, outlawed, and outraged men. When I had done with the paper, I passed it along to the other boys, who read it and handed it about till it was finally captured by the superior. It was limp and ragged from usage. The superior promptly traced it back to me. When asked where I got it, I told her I had taken it from her desk. I was lectured severely on the wrong of taking things without asking for them. I told her I did not ask for it because I was afraid she might refuse me. She said nothing and did not offer to give me any, from which I understood that we were not to have papers. I was also relieved of my job as mailman. I was no longer to be trusted. My teacher heard of my disgrace. She took me into her study, and we talked the thing over. The loss of my job was nothing. I would be going home soon anyway. I must not feel bad about the lecture. I had done nothing wrong. I would have returned the paper, only the other boys wanted to read it. I discovered that she looked at it the same way I did. She asked me if I wanted more papers. I was on fire for papers and told her so. She promised to get me one every day, and did. When I read it, I returned it to her. The James boys' story ran on for days, and I followed it word for word, sympathizing with the hunted fugitive, Frank, wishing I were old enough and strong enough to find him and help him escape his pursuers and avenge his brother's death. When that story was over, I turned to other crime stories and read nothing else in the papers.
Burglaries, robberies, murders. I devoured them all, always in sympathy with the adventurous and chance-taking criminals. I reconstructed their crimes in my boyish mind and often pictured myself taking part in them. I neglected my studies and prayers to rove about in fancy with such heroes as Jimmy Hope, Max Shinburn, and Piano Charlie, famous gopher men who tunneled under banks like gophers and carried away their plunder after months of dangerous endeavor. Looking back now, I can plainly see the influence the James boys and similar characters had in turning my thoughts to adventure, and later to crime. Chapter 3.